From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
This week on the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Political columnist George Skelton has seen a lot since he started covering state politics in 1974. From Ronald Reagan being governor, to the passage of Prop 13 in 1978 that limited property taxes, to Prop 98 in 1988 that continues to mandate a minimum level of school funding, to Prop 184 in 1994 that established California's toughest in the nation three strikes law, to the return of Jerry Brown as governor in 2011, 36 years after he was first elected governor in 1975. We'll look back at state politics and discuss how state government has changed with the dean of the Capitol Press Corps, LA Times columnist George Skelton. We'll also hear from former State Senator Dean Flores, Democrat from Shafter, Don Jackson, a key strategist with former Senate Minority Leader Ken Matty, and Cal State Fresno political science professor Jeff Cummins. California Retrospective, a conversation with George Skelton of the LA Times.
From Fresno, the Matty Report, with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. The Sacramento Press Club noted that our guest, George Skelton, quote, has had an exemplary career tracking and influencing California's political history from Pat Brown of the 1950s to Jerry Brown a half century later. And his readers are the richer for it. We are delighted to have LA Times columnist George Skelton as our guest and give us his perspective on California politics and how it's evolved over the last several decades. Welcome to the Matty Report.
Thank you.
Well, let's begin with a discussion of governors. Pat Brown, he was governor from 1959 to 1967, did a lot of big things, the state water project, transportation projects, et cetera. His tenure was fairly successful, people think, a lot of big ideas. Why was he so successful, and can that happen again?
Two reasons why he was successful. One was the state was rolling in money at the time. This is only about 15 years after World War II. State was booming, a lot of tax revenue rolling in, and the question was not how do we raise money to build freeways, build campuses of the University of California, but where do we put them? The big fights were over, where do we put the freeway? Where do we put the campus? Does the state water project really make sense? And does Northern California want to give up its water to Southern California and the farmers down in the valley? So those are the big political questions, not the money, not like today. But having said that, Pat Brown was a real leader. And could it happen again today? Of course. I mean, we just have different problems to solve today. Pat Brown was the kind of guy who could get in and bring people together and work out compromises. And anybody seen the movie Lincoln, they know how all that works. I mean, in Pat Brown's case, he gave away savings and loans charters, judgeships, and whatever it took to get that water project built. And sure, it could happen again.
Well, let's talk about another governor. You covered actually his president, Ronald Reagan. He was obviously the governor of California as well. How was he as governor?
He was a good governor. I wouldn't call him a great governor, but he knew what he didn't know. And so he would seek to find out what he didn't know. And he had a talent of appointing good people around him, surrounding himself with staff who were not only politically smart, but also were public policy wonks and made the right decisions, and he listened to them.
So we also had Pete Wilson and George Duke Majan. What's their legacy?
Boring, but they were effective in their own way. They were, George Duke Majan built prisons. Yeah, that's what his legacy is. He also was the first governor in the nation to sign an assault weapons ban, although he was a conservative Republican. So that kind of thing, his legacy is integrity, honesty, strong-willed. Pete Wilson was a feisty ex-Marine who loved to fight. Took on lots of fights, and he also came into office with all kinds of problems. He had the biggest budget deficit of anyone ever. Still is still a record, and he immediately raised taxes, even though he was a Republican, and got in all kinds of problems with his party with that. But he did that nevertheless. Of course, his legacy will be Proposition 187, which sought to deny services to illegal immigrants, and it was thrown out by the Supreme Court. But it turned off Latino voters and set back the Republican Party for at least a generation.
Let's talk about Gray Davis and Arnold Schwarzenegger. What was their legacy?
Well, Gray Davis was a sad case because he could have been an effective governor, sold out to the labor unions basically in that first year. But that's not what cost him his recall. It was the Enron power pirates from Texas who gamed the California energy system and made Gray Davis look very bad, and that, I believe that's what cost him the recall. Schwarzenegger was just a big disappointment. Everybody was expecting more from him. Why, I don't know. He didn't know anything about government, knew little about American democracy despite his marriage to a Kennedy. And he got up here and thought he knew it all, and it took a while for him finally to get on to what he's supposed to do, and he finally turned out to be okay towards the end.
Let me ask you the last question about Jerry Brown. Can you compare him, his first time in office, to now?
Well, the first time in office, he wasn't a very good governor. He let all the things that Pat Brown built kind of start to crumble. He wasn't big on highways, infrastructure, higher education. He had a short attention span. It just wasn't very good. We don't know about the second. So far, so good with Jerry. He learned a lot the first time. He knows what he can do, what he can't do. He seems to be getting this budget under control. And we'll just have to wait and see. But at the very minimum, he's a better governor now than he was before.
We're talking with the dean of the Capitol Press Corps, George Skelton of the L.A. Times. In the 1970s, it was described as California's golden age in terms of the legislative process. It's been a long time, however, since the California legislature has been held in such high regard. So the question is, what happened? Jesse Unruh was the California Speaker of the Assembly from 1961 to 69, and he helped pass Prop 1A in 1966 that created the full-time legislature. So the question is, has the full-time legislature done a better job than the part-time legislature that it followed?
Well, the answer is no, it hasn't, but it's got nothing to do whether it's full-time or part-time. The current legislature hasn't done as good as a part-time legislature because of term limits and many other factors that we can get into later if you'd like to, but the part-time legislature did do a good job. Because of its composition, it had several guys who had fought in World War II, and they were up here, and, you know, I can remember PT boat captains and infantrymen, and these guys were not afraid of the NRA or the insurance lobby or the anti-tax lobby or any of them. I mean, they basically had strong will, and they did what they thought was right. I'm not saying there wasn't some corruption in there, but they weren't cowed by anybody. So these were, and also at the time, this was a very pro-government time. Jack Kennedy had just got elected. People were excited about government. Pat Brown was on a tear, leading, and legislators were going right along with it, and they were getting things done.
It had nothing. Pre-Watergate days.
Pre-Watergate, pre-Vietnam, yeah. Right.
Let me ask about Willie Brown, who referred to himself as the Ayatollah of the Assembly. He was the Assembly Speaker from 1980 to 1995, and one of the key arguments for term limits was his tenure. In retrospect, how would you evaluate Willie Brown as Speaker?
Well, he's often described as brilliant, and I would give him that. He was brilliant about keeping himself in power and the Democrats in power. He wasn't much of a policy wonk, wasn't really big on public policy, but he had some good committee chairmen who were. Willie called himself the poster boy for term limits, and I quite frankly think that's because of racism. People weren't ready for a black political leader who wore fancy clothes and drove fast cars and was a admitted womanizer and who had Afro haircuts or whatever the latest dude thing was. And There's a lot of racism involved that there wasn't involved with guys like Tom Bradley, who was mayor of L.A. Mm-hmm. So I think that was his biggest problem.
Well, what about term limits? What has it done to the legislature's performance? Has it gotten better or worse with term limits?
Well, I think term limits are a disaster. I mean, I think the best term limits are at the ballot box. If you don't like the job somebody's doing, you vote them out of office. I mean, that's the problem with term limits is that it threw out very good people, along with not so good people like Ken Matty. Yeah, Ken Matty. I mean, he should have been here until he died. Quite frankly, he was a very effective legislator. Got along with everybody. Public policy first. Wanted to make sure government did things. And you mentioned Jess Unruh. I'll tell you a story about that. Jess once told me that if he had Ken Matty's looks, he'd be president by now. I think this was in the early 70s or something.
You know, they recently changed the term limits law, and they're allowing legislators now to stand for 12 years in one office. Is that going to help in terms of term limits, longer period of time?
We'll see. I mean, I think it will. I mean, people will be able to keep their committee chairmanships longer and develop some power and expertise there, have a greater ability to get things done. And I'm hoping it works. We don't know yet.
What about the importance of relationships to the legislative process? A lot of people say, you know, Ken Matty was very good at that. Is that important?
It's overrated, but it is important for people to know each other, trust each other, and to not wish each other ill, which I think Republicans in Congress right now do or have to President Obama. They just don't want him to succeed because they don't like him. If you like somebody, you might not give them everything they want, but you're not going to do what you do just to make them fail. I mean,
I suppose Republicans would say that about President Bush, I guess. But let me ask one last question.
I think that's true also.
In this segment, and that is the oversight responsibility of the legislature to the executive branch to make sure that the laws they pass are actually being followed. Has oversight gotten better or worse over time?
Oversight is a casualty of term limits because people are on committees for maybe 1 year, two at the most, or chairman of one committee for 2 years and another committee for 2 years. They don't have a vested interest in how that policy works out, whether what they pass actually is carried out the way they wanted it to be. They're going to be gone in 5 years, so what do they care? I mean, this is what's happened to oversight. There is none, in other words.
We're talking with George Skelton, political columnist for the Los Angeles Times. The Economist magazine once described the political process in California as, quote, an experiment in extreme democracy gone wrong, unquote. They specifically focused on the California initiative and proposition process that's redistributed power away from the legislature and given it to the people directly. So there seems to be an extraordinary use of propositions in California. What impact has that had on the legislative process?
Well, every time an initiative is passed, that's one less thing the legislature can do. It ties their hands, whether it's requiring that money be spent a certain way or a certain policy be carried out. That just means the legislature can't touch it unless they go back to the people. So it makes the legislature less flexible, and it's one of the things that contributes to so-called dysfunctional legislating.
You know, citizens believe that they make better public policy decisions than the elected representatives that they have. But those same polls show that California voters are generally fairly ignorant about the basic facts of state government. Are we just getting the government we deserve?
Well, I don't think they deserve it. I think they deserve better government, but they're getting the government they ask for.
So is it if the legislators were more effective, maybe we wouldn't see so many initiatives?
Well, actually, I think that's a myth. I think that for the most part, there's exceptions, but a lot of times what happens is the legislature refuses to do what the special interests want them to do. So the special interests then, they have a lot of money, they go out and they sponsor an initiative and they hire political consultants to con the voters into voting their way, and they say the legislature wouldn't do it, so we're going to do it, but
Is Hiram Johnson rolling in his grave?
Yeah, well, Hiram, you know, we're talking 100 years later, and a lot of things have changed since Hiram Johnson was around here riding buggies. You
know? Well, let's talk about some of the propositions, some of the initiatives. Prop 13, big one in 1978. It limited property tax increases and also created this two-thirds requirement for passing most taxes. How did it alter the balance of power?
Well, at least a couple of ways. What it did was take money away from local governments, the property tax, and local governments didn't have the property tax to fund schools, courts, whatever. So they came up to Sacramento big for money. Sacramento gave them $5, $6 billion back in 1978, and Sacramento's owned local government and schools ever since. Sacramento gives local government schools the money, and they dictate how that money is spent.
He who has the money makes the rules.
That's right. So loss of local control, that's one thing. The two-thirds vote requirement for tax increases just tied the hands of the legislature. Before that, in the great old days before Prop 13, the legislature could pass a tax increase on a majority vote, and did routinely. Passed it one year, lowered it the next year, depending on the circumstances. Haven't been able to do that since then. So that's why another reason legislatures looked at as dysfunctional, because they can't collect two-thirds vote for something without giving the store away.
Let's talk about Prop 98 in 1988, and that created significant restraints on the legislature by saying, you know, about 40% of the state budget has to go to education. What are the consequences of such attempts at ballot box budgeting?
Well, it just means that the 40% of the budget, at least, is out of the legislature's hands, basically, and it's already dictated to. Like, I mean, in the last few years, when they've had these great deficits, schools have been cut less than anything else. Poor people cut terribly. Higher education's cut. Tuition's risen because they haven't been able to spread the money around like they'd like to, just because of 98.
So, end on this note. New election reforms, you know, open primaries, those kinds of things. Is that going to make California more governable?
Well, we're going to have to wait and see about the open primary. I'm hopeful. I sure wanted it to pass, and I have great hope for it.
So I guess we're going to see on that.
And a redistricting, an honest redistricting, no gerrymandering. I think it's going to moderate the legislature and make it more pragmatic.
We're talking with George Skelton, political columnist for the Los Angeles Times. You know, some think that the political process is out of sync with the needs and desires of most Californians, and they think maybe that there needs to be legislative reforms, things like a part-time legislature or a unicameral legislature or increase the number or remove term limits, whatever. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm definitely against a part-time legislature. I think that if you make these guys part-time, you put them on part-time pay, where are they going to get the money for the rest of the year? I mean, I'll tell you where they're going to get it. They can get it for special interests. The great concept, go back to the community and work there for a while, but who's going to hire him there for 3 months, 4 months, 6 months? It's going to be something involving special interest, and I think it's going to make it more corrupt.
What about increasing the number of legislators? I'm not sure there's the public will for that.
I hate to sound like Rush Limbaugh, but we already have enough politicians in Sacramento. We don't need more. And the problem is we probably have too many right now to make decisions. If anything, we could use fewer.
Okay. Well, you know, usually the state budget is Exhibit A when people talk about the dysfunctional nature of state politics. How can the budget process be improved?
Well, you know, it is improving. It used to be dysfunctional when it required a two-thirds vote to pass a budget, but three years ago, voters in their wisdom decided to make it a majority vote for a budget, and we've had on-time budgets the last 2 years. So it's not a huge problem anymore.
What about the Big Five? Should that process be changed? The Big Five is where you have the governor and the four legislative leaders get together to solve things like the
right.
budget.
I don't like the Big Five. I mean, I think I like to go back to the way it used to be, where each house would pass a budget, and then it would go to a conference committee and then negotiate there. The governor would have his representative in there and have his input, But he wouldn't be sitting down there negotiating with just four legislators. I don't like that. I think all legislators should have some skin in the game. And I think the budget committee chairman ought to have a lot of power over the budget, and not just who happens to be the leaders. In fact, the Big Five is going to fall apart anyway because Republicans no longer have any leverage. It's going to be the Big Three. It'd be the governor and the two Democratic leaders, no longer the two Republican leaders.
What about supermajority rules? Some say that they grant tremendous power to a few at the expense of majority rule. Others say it's a necessary check on majority overreach. What do you think?
I think minority rule is anti-democracy, undemocratic. I mean, I think that in a democracy, the majority should rule, except in very few exceptions, like in Congress to approve treaties, constitutional amendments. I mean, they should be two-thirds. Bonds, maybe the legislature should pass bonds on a two-thirds, but everything else, taxes particularly, should be a majority vote, and let the majority party be accountable and be responsible. Do something, and the voters don't like it, kick them out.
Okay. Let's talk about the initiative process again just for a second. Some reforms. Should there be a higher bar to come forward with an initiative? What changes do you think need to be made there?
Well, there's been a proposal to have a direct initiative, which California actually used to have, and it wasn't used, so they scrapped it. But a direct initiative would be, or I forget, maybe it's indirect. I don't know what the hell it is, but I'll explain it. People go out and collect signatures for an initiative. It qualifies for the ballot. Then you go to the legislature and say, hey, you want to weigh in on this? If you want to improve it, change it, and if it's okay with us, fine. We'll do it without putting it on the ballot. You guys do it, and we won't put it on the ballot. We'll save a lot of money. I like that idea. Let the legislature blend in with the initiative sponsors and see if they can't work out a good compromise. That way it's vetted, you know, it's constitutional. Just better piece of legislation.
Okay, one last question, and that is, California's changing, obviously, tremendously in terms of its ethnic composition. What impact do you think that's going to have on state politics?
Well, definitely the minorities are going to be in the majority and are going to be electing the majority of the legislators in the next two or three generations, probably. Remains to be seen what effect that's going to have, but we might be able to get some gun control in those days, huh? You know, maybe the white guys are no longer in charge of the legislature.
What about the impact on, say, the Republican Party? Is that going to make them, are they going to be able to get back in the game?
Well, the only way they can get back into the game is to appeal to Latinos.
And so get past the Prop 187 situation.
That's right, or else they'll become a party of the past, history in this state, no question about it.
Well, thank you very much. I want to thank George Skelton from the Los Angeles Times for being our guest today.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. What governors and state legislative leaders have left their mark and improved the lives of those who live in the San Joaquin Valley? And who have been among our best local representatives in Sacramento? What made them so effective? We have three points of view on those questions. Cal State Fresno political science professor Jeff Cummins, former state Senator Dean Flores, Democrat from Shafter, and Don Jackson, strategist with former state Senate Minority Leader Ken Matty. Welcome all of you to the Matty Report Valley Views Edition.
Great,
so,
thank you.
Senator Flores, let me start with you. There's a general feeling in the Valley, fair or not, that we're overlooked, that the focus seems to be more on the Bay Area and L.A. At the state capitol. Which governor in the last 30 or 40 years do you think has been most receptive to the Valley's needs?
Well, I mean, in terms of the Valley's needs and really looking at the amount of time spent in the Valley, I've got to say, just from my perspective, George Duke Majan. And I was a staffer when George Duke Majan was a governor in the state capitol. And George Duke Majan, I think, had this very interesting view of the Valley. I think it was a very close-to-home view, and I think he really understood it. And ironically, I think he was able to bring a lot of Democrats to the table in his first election for governor from the Valley. I mean, people who actually moved over. We all talk about Reagan Democrats, but there were such things as Dugmajian Democrats that kind of moved over. So I would say George Dugmajian, if I was thinking about specifically, you know, the tension to the Valley and the time spent and some of the things that he felt were important.
That's a really interesting answer. Don, you know, Chuck Pachigian, a local state senator, worked very closely with Governor Dugmajian. Who do you think has been the most receptive to Valley needs?
Well, you know, I hate to say this, but Dugmajian was my first choice, too, and I would carry it beyond appearances and so forth. I thought what was important were some of his appointments. Chuck Pachigian's a good example. Marvin Baxter, who's still on the state Supreme Court, and also his attention to issues that affected the Valley. And having watched his fundraising and other things in the Valley, it's clear that a lot of that shift that Dean talked about of Democratic voters to support him was among the Armenian population that he had a natural affinity to. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why he spent a lot of time and worked on Valley issues. Mm-hmm. My second choice would surprise you, but it was Schwarzenegger, because of mainly because of his partnership with the San Joaquin Valley.
Mm-hmm. And for those folks who don't know, the California Partnership for the San Joaquin Valley was established by an executive order by Governor Schwarzenegger, and it looked at 10 specific issues or challenges of the Valley. And in fact, it still exists. People are still working on that. So go ahead, Don. I'm sorry.
No. Let's move to Professor Cummings.
Okay, Professor Cummings. Governor Schwarzenegger is probably a lot of people's choice because he spent a lot of time in the Valley, had a close relationship with former Fresno Mayor Alan Autry. What are your thoughts? What governor's had the biggest impact on the Valley?
Well, I don't know that I would say he's had the most, but certainly the most recent attention to the Valley was Schwarzenegger. So I would agree. I mean, he visited the Fresno, San Joaquin area, it seemed like every week or so. And so I thought that, you know, it was nice to have the name Fresno and other local community names out there quite often. And then, like Don said, I don't think you can discount the fact that he established the partnership for the San Joaquin Valley.
What about Jerry Brown? You had some working relationship, I guess, with Governor Brown, both in his first term and now in his second go-around. Has anything changed with Governor Brown between his first go-around as governor and today?
I think a lot. But he, by the way, was my third choice. But I think he's different in that, really, the first time around, he came out kind of as the governor moonbeam. You know, it was less is more, and those kinds of ideas. He was very philosophical. This time around, I think he's very much a realist, very practical. His ability to get Prop 30 through and get more taxes, to put the budget in a place where it's at least close to balance, if not balanced. I think he's almost like two different people in terms of what was important to him. Now he's a realist. Before, I thought he was very philosophical. Not that those ideas weren't good, but they weren't as practical.
Professor Cummings, could that practicality be because he was mayor of Oakland and he saw stuff close up, problems close up?
I mean, I think it's just having 30 years of experience, you know, in different elected positions. You know, in his first stint as governor, he was criticized for having a pretty poor relationship with the legislature. And I would say he's made all kinds of efforts to try and kind of grease the wheels on a lot of his major proposals. He's gone to legislative hearings. I think a couple of weeks ago he had over both caucuses for dinners at the governor's mansion in Sacramento. So I would say he's changed his ways quite a bit, and he has a better idea of what it takes to get some of these major proposals through the legislature.
So it's kind of style as well as substance, maybe. Senator Flores, what are your thoughts about Governor Brown? Has he changed his approach in the second time around?
Well, you know, when Governor Brown was governor, I was in Shafter High School. So, you know, I'm going to give you kind of what I think, looking at Jerry Brown now, what I think in being a student of California politics, I think Jerry Brown's trying to complete his dad's legacy in the Valley. I really do. If you think about it, you know, Pat Brown, you know, began the waterways that were supposed to be finished sometime, you know, even after his term, and never got really done. If you look about it, look at it, and the, and if you think about Jerry Brown, and here he is trying to complete, you know, kind of the water path to and through the valley. Now, whether his approach is good or bad, they kind of find that. And I also think, in you know, Pat Brown's legacy was also build these university systems that, that kind of are in our valley, not enough of them, but, you know, this was kind of his legacy. And I see Jerry Brown trying to kind of now modernize that particular push from his father in the valley by talking about things like online education and doing things that are really, really kind of legacy finishing things for the Browns, not necessarily for Jerry Brown. So, you know, he had a lot of different agendas early in his career. He was all over the place. I think now he's very focused. He has, you know, four or five things he looks as though he's trying to complete. And if you look at it, they kind of match his dad's, you know, agenda way back in the early 60s.
You know, Senator Flores, I'm going to have to ask you a question. You have to exclude yourself from this. I'll have to exclude you. But Valley legislators, you know, you've been there, done that. Who has distinguished themselves, you think, over the last 30 or 40 years as a Valley legislator?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt Ken Matty is on top of the list. And the reason for that, I was a staffer when Ken Matty was in the state Senate, in the Senate. And, you know, you look at all the budget troubles today, and we were talking about George Duke Majan, or if you even look at Pete Wilson, you know, they also had some very troubled times during the late 80s, early 90s. We had kind of these recession dips. And I always admire Ken Matty, not necessarily for being, you know, partisan, but able to walk across the aisle to Senator Roberti at that time, who was the pro tem, and they would all kind of trek down to see Willie Brown in the assembly, and they would get a budget done in a week. You know, I mean, Ken Matty was key to that. He was an absolute senator. And in fact, testament to that is when the senators caucus, even now, the Democrats caucus. We caucus in the Matty Lounge. And there is Ken Matty's portrait in the Democratic caucus. And you kind of think, wait a minute, why is the minority leader's portrait here? But I think he symbolized, you know, what the legislature's lost, this ability to put partisan politics aside. So I think he is far head and shoulders above any legislator. I think not many can compare to his legacy, my viewpoint only.
Well, thanks, Senator, for saying that, Senator Flores. Don, you worked very closely with Senator Matty. Let's exclude Senator Matty for a second. Who else do you see as really making a difference?
Well, I think when you consider that the Valley is underrepresented in terms, maybe fairly with the number of voters, but it's underrepresented in terms of the overall demographic. It's lucky that we've had so many good leaders come out of the Valley. I would start with Hugh Burns, who was a Democrat, mm-hmm. who was president pro tem of the Senate. Howard Way from Exeter followed him in that position. Bill Jones. And, you know, the jury's still out, but Connie Conway's there. I think the Valley has consistently been able to put people in leadership positions. And I think it's a question of both personal charm and intellect that they are able to do that, because they certainly don't have enough co-legislators in the Valley to put them in those positions.
Professor Cummins, what are your thoughts on this? What Valley legislator has really made a difference?
Well, I think certainly you can't argue about Ken Matty's reputation. Mm-hmm. The other ones that I would throw in there would be a couple of more recent ones, Dave Cogdill and Mike Vallines. And in particular, because they made one of those decisions as leaders that ended up ousting them from their leadership positions, but they did it for essentially the good of the state in 2009 when they voted to increase taxes in order to address a huge, huge budget deficit. And they later received awards for that, even though they were ousted out of their leadership positions.
Yeah. You know, Senator Flores, what about term limits and the Valley legislative delegation? I mean, you were affected by term limits. Senator Matty was affected by term limits. Has that been good or bad for the Valley?
I think it's probably one of the worst things that's happened in this sense. And in one way, I believe in term limits. You know, obviously having a citizen legislature is important, people serving time and taking time off to serve and kind of bring into perspective. But, you know, I was also a staffer, I think, as I mentioned, in the late 80s before becoming a member. I was there before term limits. And I saw the members, and then I see the members that I served with even these last couple years in the California State Senate. And term limits has brought this sort of transaction built, you know, one way up, fast as you can, type of member to the Senate that didn't exist before. You had Ken Matty. You had folks that served for many, many, many years. You know, Walter Stern and others, you know, and I think what it's done is it's really been hurtful. I mean, you can't take the body of knowledge that it takes to be a legislator. You really start getting to know what to do about year six. And if you're in the assembly, you're done. And even with these new terms, you'll get six more. But, you know, I think the key to it is, you know, having somebody for a long period of time working on, you know, certain policy areas that take a tremendous amount of time for the Valley, especially to get their issues completed. So I don't think it's been a plus.
Yes, Senator Flores, you're also kind of maybe touching on another thing that deals with people who've been in office for a while, and that is establishing relationships. Some people say that relationships are really key in the legislative process. Other people say that's overblown. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, no, relationships are everything in the legislature. You know, the key to it as a Valley member was to always remember that, you know, the relationships that you had in your house, normally with urban members who may not, on a policy level, nine times out of ten, have the same interests as rural. And, you know, those kinds of relationships kind of had to end when you began voting. So, therefore, you saw a lot of Valley members, you know, somewhat kept to themselves and or built fostered relationships even within their own party. So I think relationships are extremely important. Unfortunately, term limits, you know, just when you get to know somebody, you begin to work with them, they're gone. And I think that's one of the hard parts about it. You start to build the relationship with somebody who's really understanding water, really understanding, you know, many other issues, and the next time you turn around, there's somebody there just starting all over again. Right. I think that's pretty difficult.
You know, Don, a lot of people thought that Ken Matty was a master at that. He had very good relationships within, obviously, his own caucus, but across the aisle. What do you think? Did that make Senator Matty really effective, or was it something else?
Well, I think it was that. Also, his intellect. He's just a very smart guy. But I think the relationships, I agree with Dean, are really important. It allows time for statesmanship to develop, to cross aisles, to find people who philosophically agree with you on certain areas and points, even though they're in the other party. It's just, it's a caucus control now. It's dollars, it's, you know, whatever you need. But it is what it used to be, and I think we all know that. I think term limits, in retrospect, were a mistake. I know why we had them, and I think it was primarily because the voters were tired of Willie Brown.
Yeah.
And frankly, I don't think that was the right way to go.
Well, Professor Cummins, we'll give you the last word on this. What about relationships in the political process? Does it really make a difference?
No, definitely. I agree. They're essential to getting issues addressed, particularly long-term issues. If you think about some of the important issues to the Valley, such as water, air quality, our ongoing problems with deep poverty, that in order to get a solution to those problems, it can take many, many years. You know, just to try and master, I think as Senator Flores was saying, like water policy issues, that can take years and years to build up that expertise. And having those relationships with other legislators up there can help build those relationships so that eventually when the legislature is ready to move on some big proposal, that those relationships are built up. Mm-hmm. So I would say it definitely has a big impact on addressing some of the states and the Valley's long-term problems.
Okay. Well, up next, what about direct?
Before you move on, I'd like to just add one comment.
Quickly.
Big Five worked a lot better when Ken was there, and that was because Ken and Willie Brown had great respect for each other and understood the art of compromise. So those relationships have been critical all along to having California work.
Okay, well, thanks. Well, up next, what about direct democracy and all those propositions? Are they making California government better or making California ungovernable? That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. We're taking a look back at state government over the last 30 to 40 years and discussing how decisions in the state capitol have impacted the San Joaquin Valley with former state Senator Dean Flores, Democrat from Shafter, Don Jackson, a key strategist with former Senate Minority Leader Ken Matty, and California State University Fresno political science professor Jeff Cummins. So I'll start with you, Senator Flores. There seems to be an extraordinary use of propositions in California. What impact do you think these propositions have had on the Valley? On balance, have they been good or bad?
Well, I think it's been bad, in my view. And the reason I say that is, you know, the propositions created by Hiram Johnson was really to have a legislature do something that the railroads wouldn't allow them to do. So the people took it in their own hands to kind of move this thing forward. I always say California or the legislature not doing anything causes propositions. I think what happens if you look at either Prop 13 or Prop 98 and others, I mean, there was clearly a crisis occurring, whether it be taxes or education or some of the prison population, you name it. And when the legislature refuses to act, people will. And unfortunately, in today's environment, you can kind of get the proposition you pay for. I mean, you get enough signature folks out there, they get do their thing for whatever the bounty amount is, and then we have a proliferation of propositions, all named things on things that don't even pertain to what people are voting on. So I think that, you know, we have to kind of tame that. People still need a voice when the legislature isn't able to act, but now it's because the legislature refuses to act, you know, in many cases ignoring issues that has caused this. And those propositions are so tightly worded in many cases that it's very difficult for the legislature to operate once they're passed.
You know, Don, The Economist magazine a couple of years ago had a whole series on California politics, and they basically were arguing that it's direct democracy gone wrong, that we just have overdone it in California. What is your thought about propositions, and specifically maybe how they've impacted the Valley?
Well, let me deal with the first part. I think generally propositions don't see the light of day. They don't see argument. Which is why things should go through the legislature, because even at its worst, it does a better job of looking at the issues. There's give and take, there's arguments, and some public knowledge of how it got put together and why. Proposition is, as Dean pointed out, is just words drafted generally in a way to hide what the real purpose is, and secondly, in a way that benefits whomever is drafting it. So I think that overall, generally, they're not a good idea. Turning specifically, though, to some of those that we had on our list, Prop 13, if you recall, that was back in 78, and in the gubernatorial campaign, Jerry Brown came out in favor of it, which was a smart thing to do. Matty was against it, and that cost him the campaign, without a doubt. But I think it has served a good purpose, but it certainly has had a negative impact on cities and counties. So we live with it, you know, and I don't want to talk about any others. Professor Cummins get a shot at it.
Sure, Professor Cummins, so what are your thoughts about propositions in the Valley?
Well, I think I would just generally agree and form the consensus here that propositions are not good for the state and good for the Valley. They tend to be too easy to put on the ballot, especially if you have deep pockets. It's been overrun by special interest groups. And then on the back end, once the propositions are passed by voters, California is the hardest state to try and correct some of the problems created by the proposition. It takes a vote of the people to amend or change them. I would say in general that propositions have been bad for the state of California and the Valley. On Proposition 13 in particular, while it certainly helped keep homeowners in their houses, at the same time it devastated funding for schools in particular. And you can really trace, it's probably been the biggest factor in the demise of our state school system. Is that reduction in property tax revenues. So it's had a huge impact on our schools and the performance of our schools, and the state's ranking has gone down with it.
Don, polls show that citizens believe that they're actually better at making public policy decisions than their elected officials. Yet those same polls show that California voters are generally fairly ignorant about basic facts of state government. And while it may sound kind of harsh, are we just getting the government we deserve?
Well, that is a little harsh, but I do think that we all think we know all the answers to all the problems. And
I think we just solved them. I think we just solved them on this program.
Yes, exactly. The point is that I think representative government is a good form of government. You can argue about whether we're properly represented. That's a different issue. But the form of government is good because it allows discussion, argument, debate, and therefore that's much better than having each of us who thinks we know the answer arbitrarily provide that answer. So I think we probably are getting the government we deserve, but if there's anything wrong with it, it may be the question of whether we're electing the right people and whether we're encouraging the right people to run for office.
You know, Senator Flores, you're in office and these propositions are happening. Isn't there a sense as a legislator that your hands are being maybe tied by some of these propositions? How did you feel as a legislator seeing these propositions passed?
Well, I mean, I think absolutely it ties your hands. If you look at Prop 98, for example, you know, there's triggers, there's things that occur. Even if you look at the state budget, you can only have a minimum amount of money now in order to make decisions on taxpayer money with taxpayer dollars. So if 40, 50% of every dollar is locked up due to Proposition 98, that causes a whole host of other problems when you have to make decisions that impact other areas and other needs in California. So you know, every time we have a proposition, we're really locking in the decisions of the legislators, and it doesn't give them much flexibility. But at the same time, as I told you, it was really the legislators unwilling to act that causes a lot of these things to occur. So, you know, it should be a lesson. It doesn't seem to have changed much, and we continue to see proposition after proposition. And it does absolutely, you know, tie your hands when you're in the institution.
You know, Professor Cummins, I kind of want to look forward now and ask about what do you see as the role of the San Joaquin Valley in state politics going forward?
Well, I think it's going to be hard for Valley legislators to have much of a role in deciding some of the state's big issues. The power centers tend to be the Bay Area and the L.A. area. That's where the legislative leaders, at least on the majority side, the Democrats, tend to be elected from. So I would say that puts us at a disadvantage. Now, we have had, you know, most recently, we've had Republican leaders who have come from the Valley, most currently, Connie Conway, the Assembly Minority Leader. But with the Democrats taking a two-thirds majority, Republicans have pretty much been cut out of the process, you know, especially if they're able to keep that two-thirds majority moving forward. So unless there's some way that we can get some Valley legislators into those leadership positions, and particularly on the majority side, the San Joaquin Valley is not going to have much influence on those big decisions.
You know, Senator Flores, you've only got about 30 seconds left in the segment. I just wanted to ask you what your thoughts were about the Valley's role in state politics going forward.
Well, I think the Valley's role is very bright. You know, I think the growth in the Valley and the San Bernardino area continues to amaze people in Sacramento. And I think it's going to be a very active place in the next 20 years. I think lots and lots of folks are going to look to this area and see, you know, the next California. So I'm very positive and upbeat about it.
Well, I want to thank you very much, former State Senator Dean Flores, Democrat from Shafter, Don Jackson, strategist with former Senate Minority Leader Ken Matty, and Cal State University Fresno Political Science Professor Jeff Cummins, all of you for joining us. Thanks a lot. If you want to keep up to date with state and local politics, you can sign up for our free e-newsletter, The Matty Daily, by just logging on to our website at mattyinstitute.org.
The Matty Report Valley Views Edition is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio and the nonpartisan Matty Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on important public policy issues.
This is Mark Kepler for The Matty Report Valley Views Edition. Thanks for joining us.